Everything we have going is pretty much because of him. We owe him a lot. Some of us owe him our lives. We certainly owe him a search party. Find out what happened to him. We were it.
And we got our asses kicked, Clifford mumbled, his hand dabbing his bruises.
Pretty much, Allie added.
Can we talk about this in private? Gus asked Collie.
Sure.
I just need clarification.
Will you excuse us, folks?
Collie and the three men exited to the den. Bruno stopped at the door to keep an eye on the living room.
So what about our plan? Gus whispered.
Collie shrugged.
It'll have to wait. We can spare a day or two to find out what happened to this guy. We still need to secure Whitecap. But in my mind, this is an acceptable side mission. They've established a community and have gotten to this point by common sense, living off the land and whatever's left over. Sound familiar? I got the same story from each of them. They're just regular folks getting by. But this Carson guy is the beacon, the sheriff, the guiding fucking light. If we find him, we'll get brownie points. Did I mention they produce their own ethanol? That should mix just fine with our corn. Plus, we might gain the confidence of a genuine automotive technician and all-round do-it-yourself person.
I think them having access to a doctor is more important than the mechanic, Corey pointed out.
Agreed, Collie allowed. Aces over kings. But a little help with their missing person won't hurt us. It'll only prove we're good people. Eva and the others have made it clear they want him found. They owe him. Apparently he's the one who rounded them up, organized them, kept them safe.
What if he's missing because of the same savages that caught Eva and her crew? Gus asked.
Possible. If so, they're down by three. Eva already said their captors were taking them to someone called the Leather, that they were stopped at a meeting place where we nailed the bastards. That was a short way from Timmins. Carson might have been picked up in Matheson and taken back to the same designated spot. In any case, it's a place to start looking. So what do you say, you in?
And if we're not, Corey asked.
Mighty cold of you, since our second priority is to locate and establish relations with other survivors. If we continue north on our secret mission without attempting any further help, that could go against us.
That won't happen because we have a doctor, Corey said.
We do, Collie noted.
And we freed them from those dipshits, Gus pointed out.
We did that.
They quieted down, each mulling over the consequences of this new plan.
A mechanic, huh? Gus finally asked.
Collie nodded.
The sheriff? Corey asked.
Uh-huh.
The guiding fucking light, Bruno muttered softly.
And they want him back, Collie finished.
Gus sighed.
A little after midnight, a hand shook Gus. He woke with a snort and beheld the Wraith sitting next to him on the single bed.
Morning, Moonbeam, Collie whispered.
Morning, Sunshine.
She smiled.
Your shift.
Already?
3 hours later. Sleep good?
Give me a few minutes.
He groaned softly and checked the red numerals of the clock.
12:20. Yuck. Didn't think I'd nod off.
Yeah, Collie said. A lot's happened in the last 24 hours.
How's everything out there?
Good. Quiet. Everyone's sleeping as far as I can tell. Corey and Bruno are in the living room. You know Corey farts in his sleep?
I did not.
Well, he does. Not manly ones either. Little mousy things that friggin' last forever. Like air leaking out of a balloon, you know? Although there was one or two that fluttered at the end.
Gus had nothing to say to that.
I could understand if it was coming out of the girl. Those are little girl rips. But not big hairy butcherman Corey.
Baker.
Right, I forgot. Anyway, he's firing off some wet whistlers.
What about Bruno?
Don't get me started. Bruno talks in his sleep. Not all the time, mind you, but just enough to let you know he's there. He started not 20 minutes ago. The way he was going sounded like he was having a town meeting with himself.
Doesn't surprise me in the least, Gus said.
Collie shook her head. Distracting is what it is. Wouldn't be so bad if I could understand whatever the hell he's saying, but it's all under his breath. Comes out like gibberish. Just loud enough that you can hear him. Like a couple of kids whispering under a porch and Dad standing on one of the steps. In-depth conversations, though, I can tell.
I bet.
Between Corey and Bruno, it's like a midnight Morse code out there. One's doing dot, 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 while the other one's letting off dashes.
She quietly chuckled at that, and Gus smiled at the sound. A comfortable peace surrounded them. Gus lay there, studying her shadowed face, charmed by an even greater sense of how lovely she was, despite the battle history etched upon her features. He hesitantly reached out and placed a hand on her knee, and the soft contact woke him up even more. To his surprise, she didn't protest. She certainly didn't break his arm. Eventually, her hand covered his.
Come on, she whispered with a pat. Time for your shift.
Do I gotta?
Afraid so.
Gus propped himself up and leaned in close to her face. Their shoulders touched. Her scent gave him pause, a slight musk, not unpleasant at all. Collie didn't draw back. Instead, she studied him in turn. Their faces circled each other like dark moons, dangerously close, drawing even closer, considering, wondering. Gus's hand slid to her very warm thigh in an exploratory caress. Collie didn't protest, her face so near that her lips were only a lick away. He leaned in and lurched to a stop when she unexpectedly pulled back, ever so slightly, but enough to break whatever spell had befallen them.
Sorry, she whispered in that awkward silence. Time to work.
Gus drew back.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry.
Don't worry. I'll be here when you're finished.
He took a few seconds to process that.
You'll be asleep.
So sleep with me.
That got his attention.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, that would perk you up.
Their smiles returned. No longer sleepy, Gus swung his legs out over the bed and stood. He'd napped on top of the covers, leaving them wrinkled. He sniffed, rubbed his bald head, and eyed the dark doorway. Collie was already taking his place.
Nice and warm, she whispered,
lying on her back and placing a hand behind her neck.
I like this already. Always did prefer a warm bed.
They studied each other.
Collie, he asked, keeping his voice low.
Uh-oh.
What?
I didn't like the way you said my name just then.
Huh. Yeah.
What's on your mind?
He was seriously out of practice in such matters, which resulted in him not replying right away.
All in, he decided,
yet faltered again, not quite knowing how to put his feelings into words.
Are we okay?
He finally managed. Collie wasn't hindered.
We'll find out in the morning when we get on the road.
No, I mean, are we okay? You and me.
Her head turned ever so slightly on the pillow towards him, deepening the shadow upon her face.
We're okay. Let's just take things slow. That okay with you? I'll let you know. When?
Sure.
They stayed like that for a few heartbeats more, just studying each other in the dark, until Gus remembered he had a shift to do. He left for the living room. 15. The morning was cool, bright, and cloudless. Thankfully, the cabin had running water and soap, so the group of survivors were able to clean off the filth they had been covered in for so long. Once the group had finished eating, they gathered outside and inspected the condition of the SUV. The little girl stood close to Bruno, who reached out and gave her shoulder a comforting squeeze. After Collie filled the SUV's tank with fuel, Gus crossed his fingers and tried the ignition. The engine turned over.
Eva, Gus said, leaning out of the rig. Collie and I were talking. Would you mind traveling with us? The others can take the SUV.
Afraid we'll run on you?
Gus smiled. Yeah, sorry, but they get to drive by themselves.
Eva smiled back, the first bit of emotion she'd shown since being freed.
Don't worry. We talked about you last night and we decided you're good people.
Oh. Well, that's good to know. Thanks.
I'll ride with you.
Thanks again.
Gus, Kali said, I want you to ride with Bruno this morning. Corey can come with us.
That caught Gus off guard. Is this about me saying you drool in your sleep?
Might be. We did snore in each other's face for about 3 hours last night.
We did, he said fondly. Sure. Okay, I'm with Bruno.
We'll take the lead. Bruno, you and Gus are in the rear.
Right, the lanky man said. Like a vanguard.
That's the front, she corrected.
Right. My mistake. We're rear guard.
All right, Kali said. You guys get my fishing line?
Done, Gus said, sensing a joke in there about how nice and shiny her cans were, but he wouldn't crack it in front of the little one.
Then let's get out of here, Kali said.
They turned for their vehicles, but the girl refused to go with the group in the SUV.
Gus saw her pouting. What's wrong?
Bruno shrugged.
She doesn't want to go with them.
No?
He regarded the young lady.
Well, who do you want to go with?
She reached out and gripped Bruno's sleeve.
Well, that was easy, Gus said.
Yeah, I guess so,
Bruno muttered, not entirely pleased.
Ah, she won't take up much space.
Suppose not,
Bruno said, his expression lightening as Gus left for the pickup. The girl still held onto his arm. He opened the rear door and made some space for her.
Buckle up, he instructed as she hopped into the back. Seatbelts save lives.
She looked up at Bruno as if deliberating a question, but it never came. Realizing she wasn't going to speak, he closed her door and climbed aboard. Gus was already behind the steering wheel.
Never thought I'd be babysitting, he said.
We're babysitting? Bruno asked.
Yep.
Gus started up the engine. Bruno looked into the back seat for a few seconds. The girl was mashed into the confusion of duffel bags and containers there. One well-placed coat would hide her completely. He looked back to the windshield.
Ah, well, she's quiet enough.
The engine rumbled, eager to get moving. Gus glanced in the rearview mirror, checking on their backseat passenger. She met his stare and held it. Gus frowned just before he put the machine in gear. Kali and company took the lead, followed by the SUV and Gus with the captured pickup and trailer full of supplies. The vehicles rumbled around the property and moved along the road, leaving the house framed in their mirrors.
So how come Kali switched you and Corey up? Bruno asked.
No idea.
Huh. Well, he's not a bad guy, and I based that on spending 3 days on the road with him. You get to know things about a guy.
Good enough for me, Gus said as they rattled along.
A short time later, the little caravan turned back onto the main road and drove north.
Man, Bruno said with relief. Glad that's over. That is one bad road. You okay back there?
The little girl looked at him and didn't say a word.
I'll take that as a yes.
Hey, you find out her name? Gus asked.
No, she won't talk.
Did you try guessing it?
No, we didn't. Why?
Gus shrugged, staying some 5 car lengths back from the SUV.
I don't know. Maybe that might unlock something, jar a memory loose.
Think so?
Bruno asked.
Worth a shot. Unless we give her a name and use that until she tells us what her real name is. I don't want to keep calling her the kid.
Bruno glanced back at the girl.
You hear that? I'm going to give you a name, okay?
Just a temporary one, Gus added. Until you tell us your real one.
How about Louise? Bruno said.
Louise, Gus repeated. Bit old-fashioned, ain't it?
I had an aunt named Louise.
Aunt Louise? You serious?
What's wrong with Aunt Louise? There's nothing wrong with Aunt Louise.
I'm sure there wasn't. Look, I'm not making fun or anything.
I think you just did,
Well, I wasn't.
Better not be, Bruno warned good-naturedly. Ah, Aunt Louise was the best. The best. That woman treated me like gold. Loved Aunt Louise.
Maybe she should decide, Gus said. Bruno consulted their backseat passenger again.
How about it? Louise okay? You good with that?
The little girl stared. I don't think she cares for it, Gus said. How about Lisa?
Lisa?
Yeah, Lisa. Bruno turned around.
How about Lisa, then?
No reaction.
That's out.
Lisa's nice, Gus said. Little more modern.
How about Jessica?
Not Jessica, Gus said.
Why not?
Knew a Jessica once. She was not nice.
Isabella?
Gus frowned. You into classic literature or something?
Jesus, just a name.
Call her Paris.
Paris? Bruno asked with a note of disdain. You give me a hard time about Jessica and Isabella
and Aunt Louise
and Aunt Louise, and then you come up with Paris?
What's wrong with Paris?
You want to be called Paris?
Bruno asked the girl. And to his surprise, the hint of a smile appeared on her round face. She likes Paris, Gus asked, picking up on the vibe.
She's almost smiling back there.
The little girl surprised them both then by tightening up her lips and grunting,
"Hmm."
The two men traded looks.
What was that?
Bruno asked.
What was that sound? You said, "Hmm," like, maybe?
More like her name starts with an M, Gus said.
That it?
Bruno continued to probe.
Your name starts with an M? Like Molly? Melody?
She didn't take to either of those. Bruno looked at Gus.
What other M names are out there?
Fuck if I know.
Hey, watch that.
Sorry, slipped out. I'm sorry. Forgot you was there. That floored Bruno.
What do you mean you forgot she was there? She's right there. How could you forget her?
Gus ran a hand over his beard. I'm not around children too much. He then remembered Becky and Chad and hoped Bruno didn't pick up on the lie. Bruno didn't. He turned back to the girl.
Martha? Is that it?
She shook her head.
Oh, wow, she just shook her head.
That prompted Gus to glance back at her. Mindy? She kept on, trying to unlock whatever psychological knot prevented her from speaking.
Monica, Bruno asked.
That's a good one, Gus approved.
I thought so, but it's not it.
Bruno studied her.
None of these helping? Marie, Maria, Millie?
Gus scowled.
I'm running out of M names here, Bruno said. Mary? Oh, Mallory?
The little girl sighed. She reset herself and again pronounced, That got Gus's attention. That last one sounded angry. And it did. Heat rose to the child's cheeks as she struggled to produce words through lips that might have been sewn shut. One last mighty petered out into a whisper, whereupon she flopped back into the gear surrounding her, mentally spent and looking more than a little pissed off. Don't you worry, Bruno reassured her.
Don't you worry one bit. You take your time. We'll call you Monica for now, okay? That's a good name. And when you're ready, you let us know what your real name is.
Another said, And the little girl, Monica, quieted down. The three vehicles rolled through Matheson without incident and proceeded north on Highway 11. The forest on either side was scraggly and unhealthy, which made Gus think about a bug infestation of some sort, which led to memories of fire. 2 hours later, after passing only a couple of abandoned vehicles, a dirt road that might have led to a campground of sorts appeared on the right. Collie took the turn in a wave of dust, and the others followed. Gus wasn't keen on going off-road again. Not 5 seconds before he left the highway, he glimpsed two pointed nubs of wood sticking up from a mound of crushed stone, just barely visible. It took him another couple of seconds to realize what he'd just seen. That was a sign back there, he said. Or what was left of one. You see that?
Missed it, Bruno answered.
Well, it was there, chopped down right at the ankles, mind you. Bet plenty of folks go right by it without another look.
I didn't even get a first look.
That's right, Gus said. Can't check something out if it doesn't get your attention. That's the first line of defense right there.
Bruno scanned the gravel shoulders for hints of civilization, but saw nothing. Light filtered through the patchy forest, but after 10 minutes in, the trees and undergrowth began to thicken.
The hell we going? Gus wondered aloud.
Can't be a town, Bruno reasoned. Not a big one, anyway.
Maybe a campground, Gus suggested. Can't think of anything else being out this way.
The road curved to the north, and the rigs ahead rocked over the uneven length, summoning thick clouds of dust. The forest thinned out dramatically, revealing a plain of short, wild grass. Tall pillars of fir spotted the land, spaced out at irregular intervals, but the grass got Gus's attention. Someone had cut down the growth and piled it up in neat stacks behind the trees.
Holy shit, he mouthed.
Lurking behind it all was the shimmering blue surface of a lake, growing larger with every passing second. Overturned canoes and rowboats came into sight, all resting along a white shoreline.
Oh my, Bruno said softly.
The single lane they were on snaked through a park, complete with blackened barbecue pits and picnic tables.
Campground, Gus smiled. Called it first.
You win absolutely nothing, Bruno exclaimed before finishing with a whispery cheer, sounding very much like a small audience. Charmed, Monica joined him, her round features lighting up. Gus interpreted this as a positive sign. He hoped Monica would soon break free of whatever was troubling her. The two men saw a wired fence protecting rows of tilled earth just beyond the trees and the grass. A shovel was propped up against a post. All the idyllic setting needed was a few cows or goats. Gus was about to slow down for a better peek when Bruno pointed ahead. In the middle of the lake was an island. At a glance, it resembled a crown of dense evergreens, some 100 feet or more offshore. Rooftops and other structures peeked through the treetops there, and when the men neared the shoreline, they noticed a wooden truss bridge connecting the mainland to the little refuge. It was an old bridge, perhaps a heritage piece from the 1920s, complete with cedar slat shingles.
Oh my, Gus whispered, very much impressed.
Then he saw what waited for them at the bridge's entrance. Sharpened fence pickets jutted from the ground at an angle, pointing outwards and ready to impale anyone reckless enough to charge the fortification. The road they were on continued straight through that barrier of fat spears, right up to what resembled a medieval gatehouse. Sheets of iron reinforced the closed gate, while battlements ringed the top some 20 feet high. Figures stood behind those battlements, under a flat, weatherproof roof. Only their heads and upper bodies were visible.
Oh, it's like a...
Bruno faltered, not knowing the exact name of the structure.
Like that thing in front of castles, Gus said. A gatehouse. Arr.
Bruno gave him a curious glance.
Arr,
Gus repeated with uncertainty. He abandoned the joke, focused on the road, and pulled in behind the stopping SUV. There was movement at his shoulder. Monica leaned forward between the seats to see better. She spared Gus only a second before returning her attention to the gatehouse. Ahead, Eva got out of Collie's truck and approached the entrance. She exchanged words with the guards there, and some of those figures behind the battlements began to move. Gus watched with interest as seconds later those stout-looking gates were pushed open. Two guards emerged, dressed for autumn, and they cleared the road for passage. Eva returned to the pickup, and the three-vehicle parade rolled forward. Collie's truck disappeared inside the fortified bridge.
We're going in, Gus said, shifting the stick and easing ahead. Just like going into a tunnel.
Monica remained quiet, but she was pulling on the seats with little kid excitement. Gus drove by the two gatekeepers, two unshaven men who gave their truck a wary glance. Gus nodded at them, trying to look friendly without coming across as an idiot. The front tires hit the planks in a rattle and creak of trusses. The three of them were plunged into shadow a second later. They all hunkered down, just so they could see the ribbed sections of the roof overhead. Narrow sunbeams stabbed through in places, providing all the light to see that glorious rustic interior. A door on the left passed by, perhaps leading to a stairway that went to the roof.
"Oh, this is cool," Bruno whispered, a huge smile splitting his face. "You see this, Monica?"
Monica promptly nodded, her little hands gripping the cushions.
"How old do you think this thing is?" Bruno asked Gus.
"No idea, but old. New Brunswick has dozens of these things."
He checked his side.
"Not much clearance, though. I got about 2 feet on my side."
"That's what I got here."
"The whole floor is covered in planks," Gus noted.
Ahead, daylight entered the bridge as a second set of gates were pulled open.
"Nice," Gus said.
"All they need is a place to grow crops," Bruno said.
"Those were the fields on the way in, all fenced off with chicken wire."
"Not a bad setup."
"Not bad at all."
Collie's rig rolled free of the bridge. The SUV followed.
"Almost through,"
Bruno exclaimed like a kid on a carnival ride. Monica braced for a drop. The truck emerged with a thump onto a gravel road. Cottages rose up on either side, meters back from the water and well concealed behind grandiose trees and wild foliage. A huge sign with the faded image of a cartoon wolf greeted them. The character was winking and giving visitors an enthusiastic thumbs up while poised over big carved letters. "Camp Red Wolf welcomes you."
"Camp Red Wolf," Gus whispered, unable to contain his smile. "Well, aren't you the cheese?"
"A summer camp," Bruno said.
"They're holed up in a summer camp."
"Not just any summer camp," Gus pointed out. "It's Camp Red Wolf, best damn summer camp north of Wonderland."
"Really?"
"No idea. I made that up."
They drove into a wide clearing where school buses presumably would have stopped in faded yellow zones to offload summer guests, although Gus wondered if a bus could fit through that tunnel of a bridge. A series of squat billboards was situated on the eastern edge of the island. Several crushed stone pathways led off into the woods towards large structures partially hidden by flora. Flower beds flourished along the trails and buildings. A small hillside of green grass was ready for anyone wanting to spread out a blanket and sit, as well as a lengthy shoreline hedged by waist-high bluffs. There were tall A-frames and dormitories, as well as several one- and two-story cottages that might have housed the camp staff. Just to the left, at the end of another trail, was what looked to be a sizable outdoor gathering area, where several granite blocks had been placed in a semicircle facing the water. The campground was surrounded and divided into sections by well-planned and carefully maintained curtains of fir, oak, and other vegetation. Gus stopped behind the SUV, and the moment he did, Bruno leaned forward and pointed.
"Oh, look at that!"
A water slide in the distance. A plastic intestinal tract built on a gut punch of a slant and colored jungle green. The thing looked like so much fun, Gus even had thoughts of trying it out. Monica bounced with excitement.
"Settle down," Bruno said with a smile. "I'll bring you over there myself. I promise. Especially if you start talking."
"Now I know where all the rich kids spent their summers," Gus said.
"Oh, man," Bruno marveled. "This place has it all."
They climbed out of the SUV and immediately felt at ease. The air was pleasant, warm, and comfortable. Fresh. About a dozen inhabitants emerged from front doors or hurried along walkways, converging on the parking area to get a look at the newcomers. Eva was already out of the pickup and embracing an older woman with long silver hair and spectacles. Davis and the others got out, and the inhabitants gave them a warm greeting. That warmth turned to alarm when they saw the bruises. Several turned their attention to Collie's group, their eyes now narrowed with suspicion. Gus could very nearly hear their thoughts.
"What happened? Who did this? Are you okay?"
Gus tuned it all out, focusing on a few menfolk armed with shotguns of the combat variety. Weapons designed to punch holes in people while knocking them back a dozen feet. He noted more than a few handguns as well, kept in shoulder and thigh holsters. Some of the women carried sheathed knives in addition to their firearms. One bearded guy wore a cowhide vest with a wide straw sombrero, and Gus noted the collection of sidearms he had on him. Two under the arms, two on his hips, and one on the left side of his chest. The gunslinger eyed Gus in return, none too friendly.
"They saved us," Eva finished explaining, waving a hand at the new arrivals. "If it weren't for them, I don't know what would have happened. We probably would never have seen you again."
The suspicious glares softened into guarded curiosity, but that was a lot better than outright hostility in Gus's mind. He summoned what he hoped was a friendly smile, keeping his mouth closed for fear of unnerving the folks. "No Carson?" a man asked, tall and skinny and wearing a ball cap. His hair hung in a braid at the back. He had a long chin whisker that resembled tufts of cotton, but his upper lip was shaven.
"We were captured," Eva explained. "Like I said, by a group of savages."
She regarded both groups and decided introductions were in order.
"This is Collie, Gus, Bruno, and Corey. I don't know who the little girl is."
"We're calling her Monica," Bruno said, "until she lets us know otherwise."
"This is Ben Garrett," Eva said,
introducing the tall guy with the mangy cotton beard.
"And over here is Sarah Burton, Rich Trinidad, Jeremy Walton, and Jane Wong. Alfred Laredo."
Sarah Burton was the older woman with long silver hair who could have been the lead screamer in a 70s rock band. Rich Trinidad was the grim gunslinger who might have had his face scrubbed by a ball of barbed wire. As for the others, about a dozen more, Gus forgot the names almost as soon as he heard them. They were a wiry group, all fit and lean. There were others standing away from the little reunion, casually armed and keeping close watch on the newcomers. Gus didn't blame them for being careful, but it didn't make him feel any better. 2 dozen at least, he figured, even spotting a couple of teenagers in the mix. A little pocket of humanity dug in and doing whatever it took to get by. Ben Garrett finally managed a smile. He nodded at the newcomers before focusing on Collie, who stood with the sun glinting off her shades and her thumbs hooked into her belt.
"You're a soldier?" he asked.
"How can you tell?"
"The fatigues."
"These old things?" she asked. "Hell, anyone could have a set of PJs. Plenty of them around if you know where to look."
"You're not a soldier?"
"Oh, I am. I'd give you references, but they're all dead."
That was met with silence.
"Thank you so much," Garrett eventually said, "for bringing them back. We thought... well, we didn't know what to think, except maybe it might be wise to not leave camp for a while."
"You're welcome," the operator said. "Quite the setup you have here."
"This? Well, yes, I suppose it is. I'm the head administrator here, or I was back before everything went to hell. When the dust started to clear, I figured this was the place to be. And you? Where are you folks from?"
"Back east," Collie said. "Nova Scotia. Like you, we survived the worst of things and found a safe place to call home. Now we're searching for others."
"Searching for others?" Garrett asked. "Really? You've come a long way to be looking for people."
"There aren't too many people left. Not the kind we're looking for." "And what kind of people would that be?"
Sarah Burton bluntly asked.
"People to start over with," Eva answered. "We've already had a talk. They seem decent enough to me." "And to me," Davis added.
"Well, they brought you back," Garrett noted. "That certainly counts for something. No Carson, however?"
Collie shook her head.
"Sorry. We'd very much like to find him, though, if what Eva tells me is true. He's quite useful to have around."
The Camp Islanders tensed just a little, as if some great secret had just been revealed. Carson was important, even valued.
"He is," Garrett said neutrally. "Very useful."
"I'm curious," Collie said. "Why would you let such a useful person go out on his own? You have to know what it's like out there." "Because," Sarah Burton said with some heat, "he's a cranky, self-centered asshat who can be a goddamn pain in—" "Sarah,"
Eva said, warning the woman to button it. Bruno looked at Monica and frowned, encouraging her to forget such language.
Well, Kali said, I've already covered this with your people, Eva in particular. We're willing to head back out and find out what happened to your mechanic.
Yeah, right,
Sarah started up again.
For a price, I bet.
That's right. Nothing comes for free these days.
I bet.
But it's a manageable fee,
Kali continued, unfazed by the snark.
We're running a little low on fuel. Eva says you make your own ethanol.
Some uncomfortable shuffling then, and a few more looks.
Jesus, Eva,
someone remarked.
Relax, she told the islanders. Just hear Kali out.
Yeah, just hear her out for a minute, Davis said. It's not that bad.
So they did.
Like I said, Kali continued, we're looking for people. Good people to exchange food, services, and skills with. Our little community has a population about 4 or 5 dozen. Mostly people with regular trades trying to do things the old way to survive with the pieces left over. We don't have a mechanic. We do, however, have a doctor.
That got their attention.
As a sign of good faith, Kali said, deciding not to point out that they'd already shown plenty of good faith in freeing Eva and the others. We'll go back out there and look for Carson. For whatever fuel you can spare, if we find him, we'll bring him back. Talk some more. We have a doctor, and if you're willing to parlay, at the very least we can see to it that anyone needing medical attention gets it. What do you think?
A doctor?
Jane Wong asked. Kali nodded.
ER doctor, in fact, honest to God. Worth her weight in gold. She saved my life already.
That changed the vibes radiating off the group from one of polite guardedness to keen interest. Gus knew they were in business. Even the scarred gunslinger called Trinidad seemed to be considering the offer in a different light.
Or, Kali went on, you guys can decide who goes out again, from your own crew. You got a few faces here who look like they could chew their way out of a prison cell.
Oh, we can protect ourselves, Sarah Burton said, pushing her glasses back up onto her nose.
Make no mistake, honey.
Kali didn't respond to that.
What Sarah means, Garrett interjected, is we certainly do have people who can take care of themselves, but I don't want to risk losing anyone else if I can help it. If you're willing to find Carson and bring him back, we can discuss other matters further. See what we come up with. You trust them, Eva?
Enough to bring them here. Enough to ask you to listen to what she has to say.
Well, Garrett said after a moment's thought, we can certainly do that. We're not savages.
He looked over at Sarah, who appeared to be seriously thinking things over. She eventually nodded, but reluctantly. Garrett cleared his throat.
We'll need to keep one of yours with us until you return.
Sure, Kali said. Take him.
That wiped the smile off Bruno's face, and his pirate stocking cap wilted just a little. Garrett saw the man's unease, took a moment to process it, and chuckled.
Why don't we talk about this over something to eat?
Kali approved.
Sounds good. Lead the way.
And Gus knew then, as God was his witness, that they could trust these people. He sensed no scheming intent, no evil plans, just a lost group so much like themselves doing what they could to ensure their own safety and survival. Garrett extended a hand, pointing to a gravel pathway, when the ringing of a bell stopped him in his tracks, and the sound of approaching engines turned him towards the bridge. 16. The sound of engines grew closer, and the lookout person ringing the bell was seriously getting into their work.
Places, everyone, Garrett yelled, hurrying to the bridge.
Gus glanced at Kali, who hesitated only a second before running for her truck. She pulled open the door and extracted her assault rifle. With a wave to Gus, she jogged to a grassy mound that faced the far shoreline. He raced after her, and together they landed on their chests in grass and weeds. Kali readied her weapon.
Christ almighty, Gus muttered, watching the road to the island. What the hell is that?
Collie pushed her sunglasses up onto her forehead and screwed her eye into her weapon's targeting scope. She grimaced.
That, my friend, is war.
That worried the unholy squirts out of Gus. He eyed her profile before glancing behind them, spotting Corey and Bruno crouching at his heels. Corey crawled toward them, elbows to grass, to get a better look. Bruno was on his knees, halfway between dropping to his chest and curious as to what was coming. Little Monica was there as well, holding onto Bruno's shoulder like a cat dunked into a vat of ice water. About a half dozen islanders dropped down on either side of them, spaced out along the waist-high shoreline, Eva among them. An assortment of shotguns and handguns gleamed in the tall grass.
We didn't bring them, Eva, Collie said, still peering through her scope. I know. But you're here now. We'll help if we can. I know that, too.
Relief flared through Gus, knowing at least one islander wasn't blaming them for anything yet. Dark outlines moving through the trees on the lake's far side seized his attention. More shapes followed the first. A sinister parade of ill-kept vehicles was rolling towards them, spewing black coils of smoke.
Collie, he said. I see it.
Monica moaned in desperation.
I know, honey, Bruno told her. You just stay close to me.
The approaching vehicles grew louder, punctuated by the peppy streaks of motion that could only be motorcycles. The parade came into better view. A black stream of vehicles as noxious and polluted as an undersea oil spillage filled the road, speeding towards the bridge. A collection of revving engines that buzzsawed through the sleepy peace of the afternoon, no longer concerned with stealth. Trucks. Cars. Motorcycles. Then an engine came into sight, one that had no right being on the road in this day and age. The raw horsepower of a monster-sized transport blasted the air, drowning out the motorcycles. The growls of all those engines coalesced into one harsh mechanical concert, a heavy metal motor show charging the island with tsunami might.
It's a fucking biker gang, Gus said, his spine suddenly cold.
Biker car and trucker gang.
Looks that way, Collie said, watching the column through her scope.
There's a lot of them.
I know. Holy shit, there's a lot of them, Bruno exclaimed softly, no longer concerned with censoring his words.
What do we do? Gus asked.
We wait, Collie said, poised and ready for the dirtiest and bloodiest business transactions. For now.
He glanced at the operator. Her assault rifle never seemed smaller, however. Monica continued with her worrying grunts, as if trying to force words through glued lips. The motorized army turned towards the bridge, trailing a serpentine tail obscured by the tree line. There didn't seem to be an end to them, and the churning smoke concealed their numbers just enough. Gus spotted a second transport truck farther down the line, and that knotted up his stomach. Then he remembered those few defenders posted at the entrance. A part of him shouted at them to get out of there, that the island was already gone. That last thought chilled him. Since they were on an island with only one way in and out, they had no place to escape. They were trapped, unless Eva and Garrett had a couple of boats stashed away somewhere. An oily surf of wheels, metal, and windshields pulled up before the bridge's entrance, well back from the spear wall. The island's one fortification seemed as impregnable as cotton gauze against the force spreading out along the opposite shore. There, the invaders gathered and strained, idled and thickened, growing into a great wall gleaming with chrome. The pump and revving of engines growled louder as more machines pulled up and lurched to a stop. Mephitic plumes of exhaust wafted through their ranks. One vehicle caught Gus's attention. A school bus. A school bus painted black.
They're doing something, Gus said, leaning over to Collie. They're doing something over there.
Collie pointed. Within the bridge's fortifications, several islanders scurried, the same islanders that had allowed Gus and company to drive through the gates. About five of them moved about, taking aim at the force amassed at their doorstep. One thought kept repeating itself over and over in Gus's head.
So many. So damn many.
How deep's that water? He asked, raising his voice.
20 feet plus,
Eva replied. Deeper in other places. The sandbar is shallow near the shore, but it drops off about 20 or 30 feet out. Those rigs got no other way across except the bridge.
That didn't make Gus feel any better.
Kali.
Yeah?
I think we should be leaving.
You heard her, Kali said. That bridge is the only way across. Unless you want to swim.
Gus's answering grimace was all, fuck me gently. The army of trucks, cars, and motorcycles trembled as if restrained by a weakening leash. They pumped accelerators and produced smoke. A single figure emerged from between the vehicles. Clad entirely in black and wearing a mask, the figure strode ahead with a swagger that was one part drunk and three parts attitude. He carried a pole. A second character followed the first, similarly dressed, but carrying something different, an item that was a dirty shade of white. The first masked man stopped in front of the island's makeshift spear fence and craned his neck, studying the defenses. He cocked his head with drawn contempt, then perhaps aware of the time, he lifted his pole overhead. The masked man held the pose for seconds. Knowing he had the stage, the masked man spiked the length of wood into the road's soft shoulder. He worked it deep. Once planted, he stepped back and eyed the bridge's defenders. Then he turned and strode back to the rumbling line of automobiles. The second figure walked up to the pole and fixed a white bulb to its tip. When he completed his task, he also withdrew.
Oh my God, Kali said, just above the commotion.
What? Gus asked.
You see that thing?
No, why? Kali handed him the rifle. Gus took the weapon and peered through the scope. Cars, trucks, smoke. Shadowy drivers and hunched shapes gathered around the trunks. He shifted the scope and spotted the grim sign left behind. A dog's skull polished to a shine, the disturbing jaws hanging at a sharp angle.
Oh, that's fucked up, Gus muttered.
Royally fucked up, Kali added, and took back the weapon. Eva? Yeah? Tell Garrett shit's about to happen.
She would not get the chance. Somewhere behind that mass of vehicles, a barrage of oddly colored pillows was being launched at the island. They rose into the sky, shifting, wavering, even sparkling, like oversized teardrops the color of ginger ale. Perhaps a dozen or more missiles spread wide and growing wider by the second.
Stay down, Kali shouted.
The sight of those tumbling bags paralyzed Gus. There was nowhere to run, no time to run, and no escape from what was coming. The blast radius of those bombs would envelop just about the whole of the parking area and probably decimate everything within. So Gus cringed and did nothing except wait for the inevitable. Until the first of those explosive devices burst not 10 feet away from where they all kissed grass, soaking Gus and everyone nearby. Water splashed over him. He recoiled from the contact, shocked that he was still in one piece, inspecting the dark stains that doused him. Screams and gasps tore from the islanders as all over the camp those clear bladders fell and burst apart, spraying everything nearby in shocking spatters. Plastic bags. There were only clear plastic bags filled with
water, Gus said, still surprised that they were alive. It's only.
Then the smell hit him. A rancid, decomposing stench that wrinkled his bearded face and left him rattling his head.
Oh, God damn, he blurted, recoiling in nauseated awe.
He pinched his nose, trying to escape that horrible smell. Dark stains soaked through his legs, already touching skin, while a line went up his side and probably marked his back as well.
Oh, that's nasty, he winced, actually tasting the stink.
Those around him were suffering as well. Eva looked as if someone had kicked her in the stomach. One islander lowered his head and retched into the grass. People were moaning in agony, some with dripping faces where the balloon broke right in front of them. Others sat up and shook their arms, frantically attempting to dry off. All over the parking area, great wet bullseyes stained the ground, and the smell stole their breaths as effectively as plastic bags being slipped over their heads. Worst of all, there was something oddly familiar about the stink.
Collie had buried her face in the valley of her right elbow, just for a second, before coming up for air.
"Urine," she gasped. "Christ almighty, that's urine."
That both horrified and mystified Gus.
"Urine," he sputtered, pawing at a few drops running down his temple. "Piss? They're throwing piss at us and plastic bags?"
Another round of the pungent projectiles launched into the air.
"Piss bags," Gus's mind screamed, watching the rise and fall of those wobbling, shifting bladders just before they crashed down with explosive spatters.
Little Monica was saying, tugging, no, pulling on Bruno's arm as if he were a stubborn sapling refusing to be uprooted. One woman rubbed at her eyes as if she'd taken a full splash to the head and was trying to scrub the foulness off. A man appeared and pulled up his shirt to clean her face. Other islanders who took cover behind trees, fences, or even the camp's billboard, which had taken a direct hit, inspected themselves as if they'd been doused while wearing their Sunday's finest. One guy was gesticulating a what the fuck with his open arms when the revving of an engine, a big engine, flared to life on the other side of the water. The black bus rolled towards the gatehouse, and the brave guards hunkered down in the pillbox atop the bridge. Suddenly, the defenders were falling, crumpling behind their fortifications as if shot dead. But they couldn't have been shot dead, as there were no gunshots, no killer stutter of automatic weapons, no nothing to be heard over the din and roar of the motorized army. And yet, Gus saw one guy in a pillbox window flinch and drop out of sight. No one else moved, until one woman staggered through the fortification's back doorway. She collapsed against the doorframe, first sinking to a knee, then to both hands, as if searching for a fallen needle. Feathered shafts protruded from her back. She fluttered a hand, and that one gesture caused her to fall on the roof.
"We gotta go," Gus gasped, getting to his knees, struggling to swallow one breath, just one lung full of air that didn't smell like the rancid nut juice squeezed from the bag of some ancient invalid. "We gotta... Oh shit, Collie, we gotta get out of here."
Collie was rising, pulling back, equally affected by that overpowering, eye-watering stink that was as debilitating as tear gas. Little Monica urged. Her cheeks flushed, trying to get her message across that they had to leave immediately.
"Go," Gus barked and sucked in a mouthful of poisoned air. "Eva, we need to go."
"Yeah," Eva croaked.
She was crouched over, horrified by the wet spots dappling her clothes as if scalded by hot water. The motorized roar of the bus drowned out the moans of the islanders. The vehicle ran right through the spears, snapping several in splintery pops. The bus charged the bridge's entrance, and then its front end disappeared from view.
"Arrows," Gus's mind screamed, suddenly back online. "They're shooting arrows, Collie."
"Crossbows," she yelled back.
There was a short clatter of metal, followed immediately by frightening pops and the rustling of timbers. Gus couldn't see anything as a mixture of sweat, tears, and urine blurred his vision and smeared the scene. He wiped away the worst of it. Another crack and crash of metal, followed by a mechanical groan of laboring winches. There was a sad note of wood creaking to a breaking point, followed by a disturbing snap that could have been bone. Then the most unnerving thing of all. Damn near all the engines of the motorized army stopped running all at once. That halted Gus and Collie in their tracks. Little Monica was screaming now as if she was about to pass a coconut. She dug in her heels and pulled on a shell-shocked Bruno. A shriek split the air from the other side of the water, a ball-clenching peal of rage that Gus had not heard in a long, long time, but one he recognized, which turned his legs into boneless slabs of dough. But that couldn't be right because they were all. 100 more voices joined the first screamer, or so it seemed, and then a boots-to-metal charge up an unseen yet quivering gangway. Through fading coils of smoke, blurry figures appeared, flailing their arms and screeching notes of ravenous hunger. All the while, Monica was somewhere behind Gus, behind them all, pleading that they just listen to her, just listen and move their asses. A shape stumbled out of the back doorway of the gatehouse, tripped by the dead islander lying there. That stumbling figure bumbled to one side and pitched off the roof, falling some 50 feet to the water below, where the lake swallowed up the thrashing screamer in one great gulp of a splash. Others pushed free of the gatehouse, stepping over the roadblock and running full tilt across the slanted roof. They stampeded across those cedar slates towards the island. They were heedless of the uncertain footing. They ignored the danger.
"Oh, sweet Jesus," Gus panted,
his eyes on the verge of popping from his face. Monica said it best as the sight of those charging creatures unlocked her mouth so that she could finally formulate the one word she was trying to convey all along.
"Mindless," she screamed. "Mindless!"
17. The mindless charged across the rooftop, shrieking, snarling, howling. An inhuman gush of fury. Feet hammered across wooden shingles. Some of the mindless fell through rotten wood, crumpling to their knees or thighs. The rampaging figures behind them slammed into the floundering roadblocks, the impact causing the runners to plummet from the roof and into the lake where the waters churned with limbs and torsos. Across the water, figures emerged from their rides like wraiths pushing aside coffin lids. Kali squeezed off a short burst, blasting the foremost of the mindless off the roof.
"Move!"
she yelled, breaking the paralysis of those nearby. Gus moved, but only to flank her, drawing his gun and taking a shooter stance.
"This way!"
Eva yelled, getting his attention.
"Everyone to the point!"
But not everyone was running. Some of the islanders had taken a full blast to the face from the exploding piss bags, and they were staggering about as if mortally stricken by acid. Perhaps they were, as the few drops that had made contact with Gus's profile lit up his skin there as if being devoured by worms. That horrible sensation caused him to drop his aim and rub at the side of his face.
"Go,"
Kali ordered without sparing him a glance.
"Go, I'll slow them down."
She hefted her German-made Hellbringer of an assault weapon and took aim. She fired, her upper frame thrumming, the rifle's ejector spewing casings in a dull arc. Short, flaming beams of light erupted from the muzzle, lancing into the mindless charging across the roof. Arms were blown off, torsos exploded in cherry-red puffs, bodies were twisted in mid-charge and launched over the other side as if hit by a speeding car. A few heads burst, the bodies continuing a step before dropping and rolling off the edge of the roof. The charge faltered again. Half a dozen islanders crouched behind the gates. They held shotguns and pistols, searching for targets, and well aware that their attackers were coming overhead. The man called Garrett was among the defenders, gripping a sidearm while waving at Eva to get going, when a crossbow bolt spurted out of his cheek, torquing his head hard to the left. The sight of the man toppling unlocked Gus's legs, just as a shaft of light whizzed by his shoulder, missing him by a few hairs and whistling hatred loud enough to startle. That drove him into a crouch, where he retreated a few frantic steps before dropping to his chest. A wave of bolts hissed overhead. Steel flashed in the daylight, and Gus glimpsed those deadly missiles a split second before they smacked loudly into wood and rock. "Run," his mind screamed, but he was unwilling to leave Kali. The few islanders remaining at their barricaded posts fired blindly, hitting nothing. Kali was on one knee and aiming at the cars across the water. She trembled as she returned fire upon the attacking enemy. One masked shooter flew backwards as a burst tore into his chest and tossed him between the cars. A second shooter had his head blown off before he could take better cover. A third figure ducked behind an open car door, so Kali put a short burst through the machine's front in a vicious patter of tin. Shredded metal and steam peppered the air. Windshields were ventilated in harsh lines. A few nearby trees caught those steel-jacketed hellos, where the bullets chomped into the wood in explosive puffs of fiber and splinters. Kali strafed right, then left, and back again, controlling the recoil and her aim. That short but meaningful contact sent the masked shadows diving for cover. She wasn't finished, however.
"Oh, you sweet bitches," Kali whispered, searching for targets. "You have no idea."
She pivoted on her knee and turned one windshield into a tracery of spider holes and sparkling ice chips. She ripped a line through another hood, the car vibrating from the impacts. Heads bobbed and ducked, but no one presented a viable target. The mindless, The familiar undead, once thought extinct, resumed their charge across the roof of the bridge. Not wanting them to think she'd forgotten about them, Kali swiveled back and unloaded. The zombies had reached the halfway point when the bullets tore into them. Bodies jerked and jigged before tumbling off the roof. Two heads exploded in a meaty drizzle. One figure was blown backwards in a spray of dark matter and fell out of sight, twisting like a livid eel. Kali blew the leg off one completely before altering her fire and taking out huge chunks from a clump of torsos, blasting the undead from the roof entirely. The charge again faltered, the air misted with pieces of flying meat and ink. The mindless stalled, fumbling about the newly dead cluttering the path. Some tripped and fell, screaming into the water. A few actually recognized the direction of the gunfire just before 5.56 rounds ripped across their upper chests and faces. One screamer took a full burst across the chops, which blew out the back of his skull. A second later, Kali shifted and scalped another with a single bullet. She ceased firing, her empty magazine falling clear of her weapon. She turned to run just as the bus withdrew in a frightening rattle of wood and metal. A dust cloud billowed out from the entrance. Gus crouched